the unknown.
Mystery.
Space.
Science.
Have fun.
Adventure.
Suspense.
Fantasy.
Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror.
Welcome to Journey number 136 of the Journey Into podcast, featuring The Charging of the Light Brigade, as well as The Rest is History by Simon Salt. I am your guide on this journey, Marshall Latham, coming to you from base camp in boring Oregon. Well, hey, we're back with another Journey Into History segment. And sorry, I missed last month. My goal was to do this at least for a year, every month, and missed September. And, you know, that was due to scheduling, things that were going on in my life, things that were going on with Simon Salt. And then there was some miscommunication on my part on which You Are There episode we were going to use for September. And so it just came to a crunch time, and we decided that it'd be better off to skip a month. Due to our schedules, rather than try to scramble something together. So that's why I didn't have a Journey into History last month. But we are here in October with a Journey into History. This is a kind of an exciting one as well. In some circles, it's a very famous event that everybody knows what you're talking about when you talk about the Charge of the Light Brigade. But I don't know if everybody's going to be familiar with this. And I'm sure if you're from the UK, that you are definitely familiar with it. Here in the U.S., I don't know how many people know about the Charge of the Light Brigade. It probably depends on the things you talked about in your literature class or your history class. And you'll know what I mean by the literature part as you listen to Simon. But it is a very interesting moment in history. And so I'm glad to bring that to you today. And right after the You Are There plays you the history of what happened on that day, I'm going to go right in to Simon's commentary on The Rest is History, rather than me interfering and getting in the middle of it. It's probably going to be my modus operandi from now on. But let's get into it. I hope you enjoy this episode. So come with me as we journey into history, and we journey into Balaclava.
Into the Valley of Death rode the 600. Cannon to the right of them, cannon to the left of them, cannon in front of them volleyed and thundered. Stormed at with shot and shell, boldly they rode, and well, into the jaws of death, into the mouth of hell, rode the 600.
I'm standing on the crest of a hill behind the British lines and overlooking the battlefield outside the Black Sea port of Balaclava in the Crimea. Perhaps you can hear the occasional discharge of a heavy gun in the distance. Those guns are British guns, which only a short time ago were captured by the Russian troops of Tsar Nicholas I. With this turn of events on this 25th of October, 1854, a big step has been taken by the Russians toward cracking the Allied siege of Sevastopol. This siege, as the world knows, has been in progress for more than 1 month, for it was on September 14th that the British and French armies, with some help from their Turkish allies, landed on the Crimean Peninsula and encircled the fortress city of Sevastopol. But any hope of a quick capitulation by the Russians has come to an end with today's dramatic upset. It's now a question of whether even the siege of Sevastopol itself can be maintained. For the Russians have launched a relieving action here at Balaclava, which, if it continues, would seem to have every prospect of success. We're set up just behind the battlefield.
October 25th, 1854, Balaclava in the Crimea. The charge of the British Light Brigade. You are there.
CBS takes you back 96 years to the Battle of Balaclava in the Crimean War and the celebrated charge of the British Light Cavalry. All things are as they were then, except for one thing. With all the modern facilities of radio present and CBS newsmen reporting from the scene.
You are there.
You are there is based on historical fact and quotation. And now,
October 25th, 1854. A hill inside the Allied lines, overlooking the battlefield at Balaclava, and Bill Leonard.
Very black indeed for the British, French, and Turkish allies. The Russians have succeeded in taking three Allied defense positions down in the valley below our observation point. There seems to be a lull now in the battle. Both sides are regrouping and tending their wounded. While we're waiting to see what develops, let me try to describe the battlefield here at Balaclava. It's a horseshoe-shaped valley, I'd say about 4 miles long, an almost perfect horseshoe, but wide, very wide, over a mile wide at all its points and ringed by a chain of hills. Now, we're set up on one of these hills at the western end of the valley. Directly below us, about 100 feet below, the floor of the valley is thick now with tents, horses, and soldiers in the vari-colored uniforms of the Allies. Especially striking are the brass helmets and the scarlet and blue uniforms of the British heavy cavalry. In the dim distance, we can see the movements of the Tsarist reinforcements. And on the hills behind and above them, I can make out the heavy field guns and emplacements of the Russian artillery, and it's a formidable concentration indeed, believe me. Two of my CBS colleagues are stationed down in the valley with the British forces. Well over to my left, with the British cavalry divisions under the command of Lord Lucan, Ned Calmer is waiting to give you the picture as he sees it at the moment. So come in, Ned Calmer.
The men around this area, tough, brave cavalrymen, are inspecting their equipment, tending their horses, doing the 101 little things that add up to an attitude of readiness, an attitude of waiting. Waiting for the signal to go into battle, which they expect momentarily. Naturally, it's the heavy cavalry brigade under General Scarlett, which expects to bear the brunt of any attack launched against the Russian position. Nearer I'm standing is the famous Scottish company, the Inniskillen, dressed in their distinctive kilts. You can probably hear their bagpipes. And there are the Scots, the Greys, and the Royal Dragoons. Some distance behind my position, the light cavalry, the light brigade, under the command of Lord Cardigan, is making its own preparations to support the heavy cavalry in battle. We're waiting down here. We're watching. Something is certain to happen, but when? Meanwhile, Don Hollenbeck is stationed to my right, a mile and a half across the valley. He's covering the area around the headquarters of Brigadier Airey, the ranking officer in charge of all Allied forces in this battle. How do things look from your vantage point, Don?
I'm standing something closer than a stone's throw from Brigadier Airey's tent, and since the sudden, breathtaking attack of the Russians against the Turks a short while ago, this has been an area of tremendous activity. Men hurrying in and out of the tent, men carrying messages to and from Lord Raglan, the Allied commander-in-chief in the Crimea, men waiting outside for orders, for rumors, anything. Everyone here is asking the question they must be asking all over the battlefield. Where were the British when the attack was launched? There are soldiers all around me as I stand here, and I'd like to let you hear what they're thinking. Here, sir, please, you.
Me?
Yes, would you? Let me ask you a few questions for the American radio audience.
Let's hear the questions, and then I'll tell you.
All right, what's your name?
That's the first question I ain't going to answer.
That's all right. Okay, now, you're a soldier in
no,
the...
No, you don't. You don't name my company.
Well, if you don't want to...
I ain't going to say nothing if you give out my name of company.
All right. Since we haven't mentioned your name or your company, maybe you can be a little more frank.
Happen I can. My two best friends been killed by the cholera, and I ain't happy about it.
Well, naturally not.
Now, don't get me wrong. I expect to see my friends die. That's what soldiering comes to. A chance to be with your friends when they die.
That's right, sure.
But what did they die for? That's what I want to know, sir. You think it was because so as we could beat the Russians?
Well, wasn't that true?
Was it? Why didn't we move up and help the Turks at those gun positions? It'd have made my friends die in the cholera mean something, sir. Why didn't we?
Well, maybe the higher strategy.
Higher strategy. I know all about higher strategy. I was there when we attacked this blasted Crimean Peninsula in the first place. We'd all have been killed if the Russians didn't withdraw first. And all because back in London, the chaps with the wigs didn't know the water on the side of that peninsula was too shallow for our ships.
Yes, I know all about that. I believe it's generally considered a blunder, but it didn't have any bad consequences.
Bill, here, come here. Don't talk that way.
Are you leave me be, Al?
No, you don't. Excuse me, sir. I don't want Bill to get into trouble.
It's all right. Thank you very much, both of you. Thank you very
Bill
much.
Bill thinks too much, sir. A soldier's got no right to think. Come on, Bill.
I didn't expect to get such a frank statement of the complaints of the ordinary soldier, but I can say that when we have no microphone with us, we do hear such statements often. Now, here's a young infantryman standing right beside me who was shaking his head very vigorously while his fellow soldier was talking. You don't agree with what's just been said?
No, I don't.
Well, the other man raised an interesting point, though I don't think he pursued it. The point is to what you are fighting for.
I'm fighting for the Queen, God bless her.
To you, Queen Victoria means your country, and it's your country that you're fighting for, is that it?
That's right, sir.
And in what way is the Queen threatened by the Russians?
I don't rightly know, sir. I leave it to them as understand such things to tell me.
Thank you very much. And now here, over here, please, is a French lieutenant. Monsieur, you speak English. Would you just come a little closer, please? Thank you. Now, what do you think of the alliance between your country and the English and the Turks?
Well, I am very happy, monsieur, to fight with such brave men.
The three armies get along well together?
Oui. One little thing I could wish would not be so.
And what's that, please?
You must understand, monsieur, that I am a liaison officer. I come together with English command officer.
Yes, of course.
We are all en rapport. We are friends, is it not? But just this one little thing.
And what is that?
Lord Raglan, the Allied Commander-in-Chief. I would wish that when he talks of the enemy, he would not any longer call them the French.
Thanks very much. Thank you very much. And now I've got word from Bill Leonard up there on the hill behind me, so go ahead, Bill Leonard.
I have at my microphone a most keen observer of this war, one of the most respected and best-informed newspaper correspondents in the whole world, Mr. William Howard Russell of the London Times. Bill Russell, how do things appear to you at this moment?
Well, in all candor, Mr. Leonard, I'm frightfully disturbed.
Well, I know that many of us here were amazed that the British divisions did not move up in defense of the Turks, and I imagine...
Yes, I can't understand that. Of course, we didn't have much that could be moved up at the time. We weren't properly reinforced by infantry.
Yes, but when the Russians were storming the Turkish positions out there, where was the British cavalry?
To an Englishman, Mr. Leonard, that's a disturbing question. I can only say that it may have seemed more important to move the cavalry to the right, as Lord Lucan did, in order to protect the road to Balaclava. I can only hope it was the proper move.
Of course, there have been a number of mystifying things from the very start of this war, haven't there? You know, the various things that we correspondents have discussed privately from time to time.
I presume you mean such things as consulting the ghost of Napoleon as to how to fight the war.
Yes, that story about using a sort of Ouija board to communicate with Napoleon.
Well, I've heard that said, and much more about the, casual arrangements for this campaign.
Yes, such as the study of a few artist sketches of Sevastopol. That was, shall we say, an unusual way to prepare a siege.
I can only agree.
Of course, there's a further question, a sort of moral question, which is being asked in some neutral countries. I'd like to hear an Englishman's viewpoint.
I have no official standing, Mr. Leonard.
No, but as a representative of the London Times, you're well informed and... Well, what I refer to is what happened when this war started.
The Tsar invaded the Trans-Danube provinces in the Balkans.
Yes, and of course that's why the British and French troops were brought out to the Black Sea and stationed at Varna.
Correct.
But this Allied move was for defense against possible Russian attack. And when the Russians did not attack, when they drew back, when they evacuated the provinces they'd taken, there was no apparent cause for war. Why then did the British and the French invade the Crimea?
Well, we had our troops there. We'd brought them all the way. We felt that...
You mean having brought them all the way, the War Office wanted to do something with them?
Well, I'm not sure I'd put it that way, Mr. Leonard. I'd say we had to show Russia we were in earnest.
Well, anyway, thank you, Bill Russell of the London Times. And now, far down the valley, we can see the Russian troops beginning to move. Yes, there's a whole company of cavalry cantering across the valley in tight formation. Now they're wheeling over to the right, and they're coming this way. They may be getting set for an attack. No, they wheel again. All of these preparations would certainly seem to indicate that another Russian attack is in the offing, perhaps in a few moments, perhaps not. We'll try to get more information about what these Russian movements mean, and while we do, this would be an excellent time to hear from the veteran CBS News analyst, Quincy Howe, who's stationed in CBS's temporary headquarters in a farmhouse to the rear of the hill on which we stand. Come in, Quincy Howe.
Day of decision. Up to now, there's been little but confusion in this war. Its causes are obscure, involved, contradictory. Tsar Nicholas I says that Russia has set out to become the protector of Orthodox Christians against Turkish persecution. The Turks claim that Orthodox Christians suffer no persecution. The English have never seen any religious issue at stake in this war. They assert that if the Russians occupy Constantinople, well, that would make the Russians guilty of political aggression against a weak people. The Tsar replies that Britain's concern for weak people is sheer hypocrisy, that what really worries Britain is Russia's threat to the Dardanelles and to the vital land route to India. Napoleon III of France has been declaring that as a good Roman Catholic, he cannot admit the Russian claims that Orthodox Christians deserve special treatment. Well, so much confusion has surrounded the start of this war that each side calls the other the aggressor, and with a certain amount of justice. One thing, though, is certain. Whatever religious or political consequences this war will have, the economic consequences will be far-reaching. And today, on the plain of Balaclava, all these issues may be finally resolved. Always remember, the Allies are still besieging Sevastopol. And whether it will stand or fall may be determined by what happens right here today. This, as I said, is a day of decision. And just a moment, a note has been handed to me. Ned Calmer at British Cavalry Headquarters has some news for us. Come in, Ned Calmer.
I've interrupted Quincy Howe's analysis because I've been fortunate enough to persuade Lord Lucan, the British cavalry commander, to grant us a short interview.
Very short, young man.
Lord Lucan, we've been noticing Russian troop movements at the far end of the valley. Do you expect another attack, sir?
A military man always expects an attack, sir. And if the Russians are foolhardy enough to launch one, they'll meet with, shall we say, a warm reception at the hands of Her Majesty's cavalry.
Well, would you tell us why the British troops did not support the Turks holding the advanced positions when the Russians attacked earlier today?
No comment.
Well, do you expect a counterattack before the Russians move again?
No comment.
Can you tell us something about your cavalry, Lord Lucan?
Well, I'm sure that even the enemy must know that Her Majesty's heavy cavalry divisions are gallant and brave troops, and that with their customary support of artillery and infantry, they will, as always, give a good account of themselves.
Then you're relying on the heavy brigade.
Oh, most assuredly.
What about Lord Cardigan's light cavalry brigade, sir?
Well, it's no secret, even to the enemy, that there are only around 607 to be exact, in this light brigade, a very small force.
Small, Lord Lucan, but great fighting men, as I certainly can testify.
Well, I have no fault to find with the men, but it's unwise to expect too much of them. There are only 600 strong, and they are armed with sabers and lances. A little for quick, lightning action, but the heavies, General Scarlet's men. They're the chaps for the heavy work. Yes. Now, if you'll excuse me.
Thank you very much, Lord Lucan. Now, Don Hollenbeck, over to my right across the Balaclava Valley, wants the microphone. So come in, Don.
It seems increasingly clear here that whatever action develops here today will see the cavalry in the key position. For another point of view on the use of cavalry in battle, I have here a famous light cavalry officer, Captain Lewis Edward Nolan. Captain Nolan is well known to all correspondents as a blunt, outspoken man. Captain Nolan, I'd say many of your fellow British officers find you somewhat too blunt, too outspoken, although all of them have read your works on the cavalry and its maneuvers. Captain Nolan's an expert on cavalry, an expert who disagrees with many other experts. That's fair to say, isn't it, Captain?
It's fair if you call the others experts. I don't.
Well, that might be called a fair sample of your bluntness.
Well, I say what I think.
Well, all right. Now, just how do your views differ from those of some of your fellow officers?
I think all this emphasis on the heavy cavalry is rot. I think the light cavalry can do anything the heavies can do and do it better.
Well, after all, Captain Nolan, the light cavalry with sabers or lances can scarcely charge big guns and large armed forces, can it?
At Blenheim in 1704, it was the British light cavalry that won the day against the French and the Bavarians. In 1812 at Salamanca, a single brigade of our light cavalry cut through the French army. The British light cavalry can break squares, take batteries, ride over columns of infantry, beat any other cavalry in the world.
Captain Nolan, sir.
You seem to be wanted, Captain.
Brigadier Eyre is asking for you, sir.
Huh? Very well.
Captain Nolan, and he's... Well, he's not the only one moving toward Brigadier Eyre's tent. There's a stir, a bustle, as though something were... Yes, something is going to happen. The Allies may counterattack. I don't believe there's any Russian activity, although, of course, I can't see what's going on farther down the valley. So I'm going to switch you back to Bill Leonard, who commands the view of the whole battlefield. Come in, Bill Leonard.
This is Bill Leonard again. Now, I do have, as Don Hollenbeck told you, a better view of things up here, and I can say that masses of Russian horsemen down the valley are still moving about, apparently getting ready for battle. But most of the activity is in the British camp below me. Every few seconds, it seems, a man leaves Brigadier Airy's tent and runs across the ground to his company. You can hear those trumpets sounding, and I'm sure an attack is in prospect. Yes, there's General Scarlet raising his sword out in front of the heavy cavalry, the Greys, the Enniskillens, the Dragoons. He's raising his sword. I'm sure he's calling for the attack. There are the trumpets. Trumpets sounding the advance, and the cavalry is breaking into a trot. What a sight that is. Perfect, rhythmic precision. Lines of heavy cavalry are moving up and up, up. But the light brigade now under Cardigan is not moving. They've mounted their horses, but they appear to be standing by for orders. This is the heavy cavalry that's going into action before our very eyes. The Russians are moving to meet them. The Russian cavalry, I'd say, 1,500, 2,000 Cossacks and Hussars are advancing up the valley. They're formed into a great solid square and are galloping forward toward the British. I've never seen anything like this. A solid block of Russian horsemen is advancing to meet the British heavy cavalry. They outnumber the British, I'd say, 2-1, and they're moving toward a head-on collision. Those are the Russian guns speaking now. The British heavy cavalry has broken into a canter. There's General Scarlet out in front waving his sword. They're still about 500 yards apart. And there's the gallop, the call to the gallop, and now General Scarlet Sabre is pointing, he's pointing it toward the Russians. The lances go down, and there's the charge. The British heavy cavalry is now in full charge against the Russians, and the Russians have halted. They've stopped. They're going to take the charge head on. They're standing stock still. They're bracing for the full impact of the British charge. Oh, they've hit them. The first British line has engaged the Russians. The British cavalry is tangling hand-to-hand now with them. They're fighting hand-to-hand, sword-to-sword, and desperately. The British are penetrating. We can see their scarlet tunics threading through that big wall of dark gray and the sun flashing on their swords. Men are going down, and what a sight. That whole great mass of men in motion and seething with the quick downward slash of swords and the rearing of those horses. There's a scarlet tunic falling in an arc to the ground, and a horse is coming back this way, riderless. Don Hollenbeck may have a closer view of this action. Let's have him tell us what he sees. Come in, won't you, Don Hollenbeck? Are you there, Don Hollenbeck? Are you there, Don? Come in, Don Hollenbeck. I I can't see Hollenbeck in the valley below me, and apparently... Well, I don't know what's happened to him. We'll try again in a moment. But now, look, out on the battlefield, the Russians are breaking. The Russian cavalry is giving way. They're turning now. They're beginning to break. They're turning, and they're racing back down the valley. And now on the field, those red tunics of the British are in the majority. I think for the first time, the Russians seem to have broken in complete rout. They're scrambling back, wildly back, behind that protective line of guns far down the valley. That cheer going up from some of the infantrymen who've come up on the hill to watch the battle. I can scarcely believe it in this short time, in just a few minutes, it seems, a superior body of Russians has been driven back. There are men lying down there on that battlefield, more Russians than British, but many, many of each. The ground down there is strewn with helmets and swords and lances and the bodies of fallen men and fallen horses. Many of the British are dismounting now. They've won the field, and they're going to take care of their wounded. There's a pause in the battle now. It may be only momentary, though it would seem that the British would want to press their advantage. The heavy brigade may be about to reform its lines, and possibly reinforcements are going to come up quickly. Yeah, just a moment. Don Hollenbeck has finally made contact with us. Don Hollenbeck is apparently safe. He's calling for the air. Come in, Don.
There's more excitement and stir around Brigadier Airy's headquarters now. And there's Nolan, Captain Nolan. He's just left Airy, and he's leaped on his horse. He's starting across the valley at full gallop. I don't know where he's going. The only place he can be headed for is his own outfit, the Light Brigade, over across the field where Ned Calmer is stationed. I can't imagine what message Nolan is carrying to the Light Brigade unless it is simply to shift position. But then why the extreme, the really frantic haste? I can see him riding across the valley and how that man can ride. He's reached the Light Brigade and dismounted now. Ned Calmer, can you give us any information? Come in, Ned Calmer.
Captain Nolan has just arrived here. He's talking now to Lord Lucan, Lord Cardigan, and some of their aides. They're not 30 yards away from me. I must say they're talking quite heatedly. They seem to be questioning Nolan closely. He's very excited, talking volubly, gesticulating, waving his arms. He's pointing out toward the valley, toward the far end of the valley that's bristling with Russian guns. But I can't believe... Lord Lucan is definitely arguing with Captain Nolan, and Nolan continues to point dramatically out toward the valley. Lord Lucan's shaking his head now. He throws up his hand. He's giving orders to Lord Cardigan. I can't say what's going to happen here, but you heard those trumpet calls. Men are getting to their horses. Nolan is mounting, but I don't understand how... If that valley, if that's where they're headed, and I don't know where else they could be going, that valley is impregnable. There's nothing that 600 men with sabers could possibly accomplish against those guns. They'd have no protective fire, no support that I can see. But perhaps I've misunderstood all the signs. Possibly the Light Brigade is not going to charge after all. No, they're forming ranks. This is a very peculiar state of...
Come on, boy.
That was the signal they're riding. The Light Brigade is moving forward. In two lines, in perfect formation, and galloping down the valley. Away from my position here and over a slight rise. They're heading straight toward the Russian line. I'm going to try to move further down the valley beyond that rise. But meanwhile, maybe Don Hollenbeck across the valley from me at Brigadier Airy's headquarters. Maybe he knows what's in the wind. So come in, Don Hollenbeck.
Headquarters here is in an uproar. The Light Brigade certainly does seem to be charging straight into the main Russian line. They're beginning to ride by now just as if nothing could stop them. Some of the officers here say that Captain Nolan has made a terrible mistake. They say he did not carry an order for the Light Brigade to charge, simply to advance to a forward position. And they feel he either misunderstood that order or he deliberately misinterpreted it so that he could put his theories about light cavalry to a test. That's all from here now. Over to Bill Leonard on the hill overlooking the valley. Come in, Bill Leonard.
In the distance, those 600 cavalrymen of the Light Brigade are definitely heading straight down the valley. There can be no question about it. The Russians, at least 2,000 of them, are drawn up in two solid masses behind a wall of cannon stretched across the valley. Not only that, the hills overlooking that main Russian line are studded with field artillery, and the Russians even have troops in reserve behind their lines. This is the formidable offense the 600 British cavalrymen are going to attempt to breach. The Russians are braced, waiting, and the light brigade is getting closer and closer. Aren't they going to turn back? I can easily pick out Captain Nolan in the vanguard. And there go the guns. Stop it. They must be going to turn away. This must be a feint. No, they're dashing straight into the fire of those guns. That line of guns is one great sheet of flames. And this is awful. Men are going. Captain Nolan just tumbled from his horse, and now the guns and nails on both sides have opened up on the British. They're caught in the crossfire. Horses rearing and wanting to turn, and the horsemen desperately pushing them forward and still forward. And now they've reached the line of cannon. They're hurling themselves on the Cossacks and Hussars, the massed Russian cavalry, and hopelessly outnumbered. Of course, there were what is it? 600 men in the charge. There are many, many fewer now, and they're going down and down, and all the Russian artillerymen have turned their line of cannon around there. They're firing straight into that mass of men. Russian guns are shooting into that struggling mass of friend and foe alike. Yes, the Russians have turned their guns on their own men tangling with the British. Horses without riders are running in crazy circles around the battlefield. It can't go on much longer. It just can't. The carnage is unbelievable. Now the British light cavalrymen, those few remnants of those 600, are beginning to withdraw and making their way back through the Russian line of guns. And as they make their way back, many of them more are falling and going down. The Russian cannon have stopped firing. Their terrible work is finished. The cannon are quiet. It's over. It's really over. There are just a few straggling British survivors coming back out of that valley of horror, most of them on foot and many of them wounded. The Russian cavalry, Russians are not pursuing them. They're not following at all. They're back there behind their line of artillery, and it's clear that they, too, have suffered heavy losses. Now I see that the nearest of the British survivors are a good way up the valley. I can see Ned Calmer all set up now, far over to the left. I see him there with the soldiers moving painfully past him, slow and in halting retreat. And so we switch you now to Ned Calmer. Come, Ned.
I'm quite near the men as they return from the horrible slaughter that we've just witnessed. They're coming quite close to me now. I'm going to try to get some of them to speak to you.
Yes, sir, you. Would you let me ask you a few questions?
No, leave me alone. Leave me alone.
Corporal, could you come here for just a moment?
No, I got to get these men back.
I'm never going to get any of these men to talk. I'm supposed to tell you what I've seen, but I can think only of these men of the cavalry. I've lived with them for weeks now. I've come to know them well. They're my friends. They're coming back now, some of them are. Maybe you can hear them going past. A few feet from me. Well, I'm a reporter. I should give you facts and figures and statistics. 607 of my friends of the Light Brigade went into this charge today. It's difficult to estimate, but I'd say only 150 of my friends have come back. And in England, there are 607 homes where this charge of the Light Brigade will never be forgotten by children and parents and widows. There's been nothing decisive on this battlefield yet. It still remains to be seen whether the Russians will take Balaclava.
October 25th, 1854, Balaclava in the Crimea. The British Light Brigade charges a vastly superior Russian force. You are there.
You've been listening to The Charge of the Light Brigade in the series You Are There. Today's program was written by Robert Sonadella, directed by John Dietz, and produced by the CBS Documentary Unit under the supervision of Werner Michel. William Howard Russell was played by Gibson Parker, Mercer McLeod was Lord Lucan, and Burford Hampton was Captain Nolan. Others in the cast included Guy Sorrell, William Padmore, and Alf Shirley. You Are There is brought to you every fourth Sunday. The next broadcast will be heard Sunday, March 19th at the same time over most of these same stations.
Hi and welcome. I hope you enjoyed that recording of You Are There and The Charge of the Light Brigade. I'm Simon Salt and this is The Rest is History. That sound is the sound of the bugle that was used at the Battle of Waterloo in 1815 and was later played exactly like that by bugler, trumpeter Landry, who in fact sounded that charge at the Battle of Balaclava, the charge that ordered the Light Brigade into action. It was recorded in 1859 on an Edison scroll. So what you're hearing there is real history. You're hearing the sound, the very same sound played by the same man that those cavalry men heard that led them to their deaths. This was the charge forward to the guns. As always, I'm going to give you a little background as to why this battle was being fought, what this action was all about. This battle was part of the Greater Crimean War. Crimean War lasted from October 1853 to February 1856. It was one of the large and ongoing disputes in Europe. But this spread further. It involved the Ottoman army, the Ottoman Empire, rather, Sardinia, France, Britain, and Russia. The British, the French, the Ottomans and the Sardinians were on one side, the Russians on another. In many ways, this was a religious war. It had broken out over the treatment of the minority Christians living in what is known as the Holy Land, Palestine, Jerusalem, Israel area that we would think of today. And the minority Christians claimed persecution, and the Ottoman Empire, which was normally at this time, by the late 1800s, the mid-1800s, was nominally Muslim. It had been at its peak, from its earliest days in the late 1200s, a strong Muslim nation, or a coalition of Muslim nations. But that had declined, and certainly the Ottoman Empire itself was in decline, and hence its allegiance with Britain and with France. It no longer fought battles on its own. It needed the support of its allies. Russians said that all of the Orthodox Christians living in the Holy Land should be under their protection, and therefore Russia should have a presence in the Holy Land. The French said, well, the Catholics who live there should come under our protection, France being a Catholic nation. So they wanted a presence there. And, of course, the Ottomans didn't want anybody to have a presence there other than them. It was, you know, part of their empire. The British, which is primarily a secular country, even in the 1800s, didn't really see a religious argument, but they very much saw a political one. They did not want the Russians to have a foothold at that end of the Mediterranean. It would be far too strategically bad for the British. Remember, at this time, the British military is the largest in the world. It is the most powerful in the world. And a lot of that power is extended through the use of the Royal Navy. So they do not want the Russians to be able to interfere with the Royal Navy's operations in the Mediterranean and in the Middle East. So this was of great concern to them. So they sided with the Ottomans and said, okay, you know, we will form an alliance and we will stop the Russians from doing this. So they deposit their troops with the Ottomans' aid in this area and proceed to try and defeat the Russians. And at first, they have some minor successes, and then they have this big setback. Here in this valley, the Turks, as they're referred to in the recording, really the Ottoman Empire, had been manning these guns and had lost control of them to the Russians. The guns in question were actually up on the top of the hills in what are known as redoubts. That's a fortified location for a gun. Now, there's been a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking of the Charge of the Light Brigade, as both a British schoolboy and a former member of the British military. I've been exposed to many, many, many different discussions of just how poorly this was executed, the lack of intelligence that was applied. I mean by that military intelligence, though the lack of thought also plays into it. And also the lack of understanding in military battlefield communications. So the side that says the charge was never ordered argues it this way, that the commander ordered the light brigade forward. And the object of them moving forward was to provide screen so that the guns in the redoubts could be retaken, or at least the Russians pushed back away from them and not allow them to take the guns with them. That's the point of light cavalry. They are quick, they're fast, and they would be able to rout the Russians, push them away from the guns, and allow the guns to either be recaptured or at least not lost. Now, the Russians also had their own guns at the other end of the valley. And here is where Captain Nolan was criticized, and here is where we see this miscommunication. So the miscommunication apparently happens because Nolan rides up to Lord Cardigan, who is in charge of the Light Brigade, and says, you are to attack, and makes a general sweeping motion. Cardigan questions him and says, what exactly am I supposed to attack? And Nolan points out the guns, to the guns. Now, his orders were for the guns in the redoubt. It's unknown as to whether he actually pointed to them or whether he pointed to the guns at the far end. He was, as we heard in the recording, a big fan of the light, and he felt that they could do anything. And so possibly, to prove a point, he pointed to the Russian guns at the end of the valley. Either way, it was never known, it never will be known. Nolan was killed in the opening minutes of the charge. So whatever his intent, he paid for it, along with hundreds of other cavalry. So what really happened? What was really going on? Well, this battle was poorly planned. As you heard, some of the reconnaissance, which today would be done by specialist troops, in those days would have been done, in fact, by the Light Brigade, was not done. In fact, they relied on paintings, local accounts, and a few sketches. This led them to not really understand the lie of the land, which is incredibly important when you're maneuvering troops. More so, it was a conflict between two very, very strong personalities, Lord Lucan and Lord Cardigan. They were, in fact, brother-in-laws and had bad blood, as it were, an enmity that had lasted 30 years between them. And certainly it appears in later analysis of the charge that had Lucan's heavy brigade come to the aid of the light brigade, then the losses may well have been mitigated and, in fact, greatly reduced, possibly even leading to a swifter victory. It is interesting to note that the analysis also shows that had Raglan's command, which was to take the guns on the hills, been followed, the losses would have been catastrophically worse, leading to far more deaths. So the whole whole event was a losing battle before it was fought. It was a terrible mistake, something that is still being used in British military and other military academies around the world to highlight the need for real intelligence, to highlight the need for very clear, precise communication, and to also highlight the fact that careful planning prevents these types of disasters. In 1945, Churchill, at the Conference of Yalta, you know, which was busy dividing up what Europe would look like in the post-World War II era, insisted on being taken to the battlefield at Balaclava so that he could see for himself, to walk the ground and see for himself exactly where this battle had taken place. It is often in British schoolboy history thought of as a great victory, a gallant victory. The valiant 600 who rode into the valley of death with no thought for themselves. Whether that's really true or not, certainly these men rode to their deaths. They did not flinch. They did not waver. They rode forward as they were ordered. The problem for this type of blind obedience is that it set up the British military, and in fact, many other European armies, for the next set of engagements, right up to and including the beginning of World War One, when we think of trench warfare and the men, quote unquote, going over the top and being mown down in their thousands by machine gun fire, both British and German. This was the same mentality that had led to the deaths at the hands of the Russians with the charge of the Light Brigade. It was that same mentality. It was this death or glory understanding of battle. The French general who watched the action said, "It is glorious, but it is not war. It is folly." And, you know, he really summed that up, that this was not how you fought. You didn't throw good lives away simply to try and prove a point. But at this time, in this space, and at that moment, that was how it was for battle. And so it goes down in history as a glorious victory, in fact, known in some circles as the worst victory the British military has ever experienced. There were some interesting things to come out of the Crimean War other than the charge of the Light Brigade. In fact, some of those may actually impact you on a daily or a weekly or a monthly basis, or maybe in a seasonal basis. You may own some things that were born during the Crimean War. Lord Raglan was the commander of the cavalry units. You may have heard of a Raglan sleeve. Raglan sleeves were designed for Lord Raglan during the Napoleonic Wars by the clothing designer Aquiscutum, still around today, still a famous brand. In America, they're most commonly seen on what you call baseball shirts. That's a Raglan sleeve, designed for him so that he could still draw his sword, even though his arm had been injured. The cardigan, if you own a cardigan, particularly the type without sleeves but with buttons, that was created for Lord Cardigan, the commander of the Light Brigade. For the Crimea War, his wife designed it. He wanted something warm to wear under his uniform. He wanted it to still look smart, but it needed to be wool. And so he asked his wife for something of that line to be made for him that looked like a waistcoat, or what you call a vest, a knitted vest. And so we have the cardigan coming out of the Crimean War. And we also have the balaclava, exactly where the battle was fought, what is sometimes known in North America as a ski mask, the difference being that balaclavas are usually knitted. And these were worn under helmets to keep the men's faces warm in the freezing cold temperatures in the Crimea. And of course, perhaps most famously, we have Florence Nightingale, the mother of modern nursing, who founded nursing schools and taught principles based on the lessons she learnt treating British and enemy soldiers in the Crimean War. Their treatment, the constant checks, the round, if you've ever been in a hospital and been woken up in the middle of the night by a nurse checking your vital signs, you may thank Florence Nightingale for that, hence her name, the Lady of the Lamp, for doing those checks that previously nobody had really done. It was a bit of hit and miss, but she drew up these principles for the care of the wounded. And thanks to her, we have modern nursing. This is an interesting time in war that we now have these elements. And in fact, you look at a lot of wars from as early as the 1600s through to modern day. A lot of things that we perhaps take for granted in our everyday lives come from warfare. Where would we be today without, for example, Wi-Fi, which was invented for military use, and Bluetooth signals? How would you sync your phone with your computer or your headset without Bluetooth? These forms of modulating frequencies were invented for military uses and found their way into civilian life. But I think the birth of modern nursing, the invention of the balaclava, the invention of the cardigan, and the popularization of the Raglan sleeve are unknown, perhaps, to many, and yet seen everywhere. So when you think about the charge of the Light Brigade, don't necessarily think of just the 600, but also think about the other things that came out of it. And perhaps one of the most telling phrases that I've heard used even recently in terms of not questioning what you're told, but simply to do it, came from Alfred Lord Tennyson's poem, The Charge of the Light Brigade, which was popularized many years after the actual event. Theirs not to make reply, theirs not to reason why, theirs but to do and die. Into the valley of death rode the 600. I'm Simon Salt, and the rest is history.
Thank you, Simon. I appreciate those words and the time that you put into having great commentary on these historical events. And, it is interesting, I think. I've always heard the story of the Light Brigade as a story of valiant courage and determination to fight on even in desperate circumstances. And, maybe that is misplaced. Maybe this wasn't a glorious moment. Maybe this is the failure of a leader or the failure of communication. And it is a very tragic event in history that these men died doing the wrong thing. But I do think there is a lot to be said for fighting for what you believe in or fighting for a cause, even if you know the outcome is inevitably against you. You are going into a situation where you might die, but you're doing it for what you believe in. And a lot can be said of, whether military endeavors are something that you should believe in. But, I do support the militaries. And I'm not saying they're perfect. I'm not saying every commander and every person in the military is a great person and good at their job. But I think the majority of the people in the armed services are doing it for the right reasons, are doing it because they believe in their country. They believe in what they're doing. But I definitely have a respect for anybody that would fight for what they believe in against all odds and knowing that they probably won't survive the outcome. Whether it's king and country, queen and country in this instance, or, whether it's for somebody's personal beliefs. And, while in hindsight, this might not be the perfect example of when a sacrifice like this is necessary. But in the heat of the battle, these men were doing what they were trained to do. They were trained to follow the orders of their commander. And they probably didn't have a lot of time to question whether it was the right thing or not. And they didn't lack for courage or resolve or dedication to their cause. And I definitely have a lot of respect for that. Despite it being so tragic and so unfortunate and probably misplaced. And so I think we should mourn their loss and we should feel sorrow for the devastation that occurred. But I also think we should hold them in high esteem and remember the sacrifice that they were willing to make. And that's all I have to say about that. What do you think? Why don't you leave us a comment on Facebook or tweet us on Twitter or call our voicemail line at 77J-107 and let us know what you thought about this episode. You can also join us on the forums at journeyinto.freeforums.org, and you can also send me an email at journeyintopodcast@gmail.com. Thanks again to Simon. Thank you guys for listening to this podcast. Until next time, stay safe out there and journey on.
This is Nicole Villacrez from the Drama Pod, and I'm here to tell you that the Journey Into podcast is produced under a Creative Commons Attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license. This means that while you cannot change it or sell it, you are encouraged to share it however and with whomever you would like. The theme music for the podcast has been provided by Man in Space.